This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Temperatures are falling, but Wisconsinites can still enjoy plenty of outdoor recreational activities like hiking, biking, and kayaking.
From the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore to the North Country Trail to the Ice Age Trail, the state offers more than 2,500 trails.
Wisconsin's Kenneth Casper dedicates his life to the great outdoors and shares local destinations to visit through his online blog. It's called Wisconsin Explorer. Casper joined WPR's Alex Crow to share where people can get their steps in while enjoying the crisp fall air and colors.
So you are a Wisconsinite through and through. You grew up in Wisconsin and you've always loved the outdoors. Tell me a little bit about what you have been doing this fall, that paddling and canoeing. Where have you been?
So in September, I was up in the Boundary Waters for a week. And then in late September, we had a run of really good weather. And I thought, you know, there's probably peak colors up there. So I ran up to a place called Sylvania Wilderness, which is just across the border in the UP, just up the road from Eagle River. And it was a fantastic trip. It was really colorful with the leaves, and I got a great show of northern lights and had a terrific time for 4 days just paddling and fishing.
You know, we've been kind of blessed with some warmer weather, at least up until this point so far. So water sports might actually still be on people's mind. We've talked about it a little bit, but what are some other places you recommend going to this time of year?
Yeah, so I like to do most of my canoe camping in the northern part of the state. And one of the best places that I found this year is the Northern Highlands State Forest. There's flatwater lakes, rivers, and they're all connected by portages. So you can find free campsites last minute, and you can really get immersed in the wilderness up there. As we're progressing through the later portion of fall, it's kind of better to focus your hiking and outdoor activities on the southern part of the state, so south of Wausau, I think. And my favorite area is the Driftless area, which is the southwestern part of the state. There's lots of hills and rivers and plenty of forests. So if you're looking for those fall colors, we're in peak right now, and we should be there for a couple weeks.
All right. So I understand that you have a list of places that you can go to hike and camp throughout, you know, the months of October and November. Is there any place that you're planning to go that people should also consider?
Yeah, I think, you know, and like I mentioned, the Driftless area is like always been attractive to me. What I like to do out there is make like a driving tour with a bunch of short hikes in between. So one example is I might start, find my way to Richland Center and then drive towards the heart of the Driftless area, which is the Kickapoo River Valley Reserve. Along that road, you'll be able to stop at places like Rockbridge County Park, which is this short hike, but really interesting. You go through a stone tunnel and come out by a little creek, and there's plenty of fall colors to see there. And then you hop back in the car and make your way up to Wildcat Mountain State Park, where there's a number of great hikes. My favorite one there is the Hemlock Hardwoods Trail, which is on the other side of the road from Wildcat Mountain State Park, down by the canoe launch is where it starts. It's a pretty hard trail because it's a lot of climbing, but you are in the trees and you have beautiful views of the Kickapoo River.
All right, since you're really experienced in all this stuff, I got to ask, is there any, you know, area that is really not well known that you think folks should check out? Maybe something that a lot of people don't know about?
Yeah, that's a fair question. I think there's a lot of places that fall under the radar. I think when you're thinking about this time of year and it starts to get cold, one thing that people don't think about is these off-the-grid camper cabins that you can hike into. There's one in the Burnett County Forest. You can reserve it, and you hike in just a couple miles. There's no electricity or plumbing, but there is a potbelly stove, so you can be warm, staying overnight, and just be really immersed in the wild.
Kenneth, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Alex.
That was blogger Kenneth Casper talking about the top destinations to visit this fall to enjoy hiking, biking, and kayaking. And you can join in with the places that you have found this time of year. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org and tell us your great finds for perhaps a weekend or where you went on an amazing hike hike in the Driftless and saw such great color. Email wisconsintoday at WPR.org, or you can call or text to get in touch at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
And if you're looking ahead to Thanksgiving, where are you planning to enjoy some great Wisconsin scenery this Thanksgiving season, or maybe hunting season around the same time? Love to hear your favorite spots this time of year. Again, email wisconsintoday at WPR.org. That's wisconsintoday at WPR.org. Now, there's been a big back and forth over SNAP benefits during the federal government shutdown. They were gone. Then they were partly there. Now that a federal judge has ordered that they come back completely, the Trump administration challenging that decision. Governor Evers weighs in with an announcement. What is going on with these food benefits in Wisconsin? WPR's own Sean Johnson is following that story. Going to bring us up to date. Sean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob.
Okay, so we have Governor Evers weighing in on SNAP benefits. Now, what are we hearing from the governor after this whiplash, really, over the last few days on SNAP?
Yeah, I mean, whiplash is a pretty good term for it. Last night, we heard from Governor Evers, after this most recent federal court decision, that the state of Wisconsin would move forward with paying about 700,000 people who receive food share benefits immediately, and that they may get their benefits as soon as the morning. That's a pretty huge departure from the announcement from Wisconsin's Department of Health Services, which administers food share here. They said earlier this week that you could be looking at weeks, potentially months, of delays to get this partial payment of SNAP out the door because of all the changes that had been kind of put into motion with, missing the payment at the start of the month.
Okay, now I hear this, but I wonder if I have a SNAP benefit card and I walk into my local grocery store right now, is it going to work? Do we know that?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I would say, sitting here talking to you right now, I would be very reluctant to say yes, of course, because all I have is a press release from the governor saying this, we're doing this, you know, and it's a pretty hairy situation. We know that while a judge said yesterday that you, the Trump administration, have to make a payment of the full benefits this month, we know that the Trump administration, the USDA, Department of Agriculture, vowed to immediately appeal that ruling. And so the USDA, the Trump administration, doesn't see things the way that the judge sees things. The Evers administration here in Wisconsin has adopted the judge's vision of it based on their action last night. I would just be a bit reluctant to sit here and tell you right now that the Evers plan worked.
There was some talk, and some states have done this around the country, Sean, of trying to backfill, right, when these SNAP benefits weren't coming through, tapping into some kind of state reserve. It seemed like that really was never getting off the ground here in Wisconsin. Do I have that right?
You have that right. I mean, it would be a pretty substantial undertaking here because you're not talking about a pot of federal money that's kind of sitting around. We sort of got used to that over the last several years because there was this influx of federal funding through all these COVID relief bills to the point that Governor Evers had kind of his own rainy day fund of sorts, you know, this money, this federal money that he controlled. And with that kind of money, he could just move it wherever he wanted. Basically, he didn't need the legislature's okay. But if you're talking about that money is now gone, and if we're talking about state funding, that needs buy-in from the legislature, which is controlled by Republicans, and the governor. And beyond that, food share is an expensive program. Mm-hmm. I mean, it costs a lot of money to run. And so it's the kind of thing that the state of Wisconsin certainly could backfill in the short term. But when you don't know how long that short term is going to last, it is maybe a risky venture. I mean, you've just heard from Governor Evers and Republican lawmakers. This is a federal issue. Mm-hmm. And so that's where they're pointing their attention.
Yeah, that question of the shutdown ending, it could hypothetically end today. So if we had run through that legislative process, appropriated funds from the state surplus, put it out there, and then we might be reversing that tomorrow if the shutdown ends. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I mean, and you see what happens with the sort of machinery of government here when it stops. Things kind of go wrong. You know, just missing a payment at the beginning of November, it initially seemed like that threatened to delay payments for weeks or months. So the moment that you kind of change these systems that have existed for, you know, years and decades, problems happen.
Now, we had Governor Evers declare, this is a handful of days ago, a state of emergency in Wisconsin over the shutdown, saying, quote, agencies would take any and all necessary appropriate measures to address various kinds of things there. How much power, how much authority does that really give state agencies, though?
I don't think there's too much, really. I mean, it doesn't give state agencies the power to, you know, pay for these benefits, which is what you're really looking for at the end of the day. It gave state agencies the power to waive administrative rules that they felt would get in the way of addressing this emergency. And it gave the state the power to crack down on price gouging if, you know, it saw that that was happening. But it doesn't fix the problem. You know, it was sort of like an action that the governor could take unilaterally to show people, hey, I'm doing something. But it's not going to put money into people's pockets to buy food.
Very briefly, Sean, as we wrap up this SNAP story, in flux still clearly, what are you watching for next?
I mean, we're kind of watching for what happens in the United States Senate, like the rest of the country, I suppose, and what happens with our senators specifically. Tammy Baldwin and Ron Johnson have not seen eye to eye on this government shutdown and specifically, you know, whether to extend these enhanced credits for buying health insurance through the Affordable Care Act. Tammy Baldwin wants to extend those to end the shutdown. Ron Johnson does not. Mm-hmm. And so that's a pretty big standoff between the two sides.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's WPR's Sean Johnson bringing us up to date on the latest in the back and forth over SNAP funding in Wisconsin during the federal government shutdown.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a Carthage College research team lands a NASA prize to build hardware for an innovative method to refuel in space.
We're essentially pushing bubbles around like a leaf blower inside the tank. And our idea is fairly unique. It got some attention from this competition.
A Wisconsin lab helping to pave the way for future space missions. That's next. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Verrett. A research team led by a Carthage College physicist has won a prize from NASA worth up to $500,000. They're one of only 10 selected in the nation for the NASA Tech Leap Prize.
The Carthage team is developing new hardware and an innovative way to do in-space refueling. Their work will ultimately help to pave the way for sustained missions to the moon and Mars.
But the timeline for developing their payload is tight, and NASA is also dark during the government shutdown.
Kevin Crosby is a professor of physics, astronomy, and computer science at Carthage College and director of the Wisconsin Space Grant Consortium. Kevin, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. It's so good to be here.
And Samaje Farmer is here, a senior majoring in physics at Carthage College. He completed a summer internship at NASA's Johnson Space Center, working on research to make in-space refueling more efficient. Samaje, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Kevin, NASA awarded this prize for your research on microgravity ullage trapping. And for those of us who aren't around space shuttles and launch pads, can you give us a working knowledge of what this research is?
Sure, yeah. So it essentially draws back to a really difficult and unsolved problem in getting folks to the moon, which is that we don't know how to refuel spacecraft. Nobody's ever done that before. So part of the so-called Artemis mission architecture, Artemis is the program that will put folks back on the moon for the first time since 1972, has these technology roadblocks, things that are unsolved, one of which is refueling. And so our contribution to that problem is this method of being able to move the gas portion inside the propellant tank to one end of the tank so you can release the pressure when you are refilling liquid from the other end. So we're essentially pushing bubbles around like a, you know, a leaf blower inside the tank. And our idea is fairly unique. So it got some attention from this competition.
Samadji, I mean, you've been working on this for a while now. Why is servicing propellant tanks really important? I think you've called it like the plumbing end of space. Why is this so critical?
Because if we want to start doing more large scale missions, like going beyond the moon and going to Mars and places like that, then we can't just keep throwing away our fuel tanks after we're done with them. We need to start building up a more sustainable infrastructure for these kinds of things. And the easiest way to start that is to get this refueling thing settled, because we can't go all the way to Mars and then come all the way back safely if we have to load up the rocket with so much fuel. Instead, we just want to be able to refuel it when it gets there so that it has the fuel it needs to return after the mission's over.
Kevin, this research, you've been awarded $500,000 to continue it for NASA. How will the money be spent?
This is kind of a unique situation for us because it is a prize instead of a grant. Normally, NASA awards grants, but more recently, for some of the more daunting technology challenges, they've sort of opened up this prize competition where you can essentially propose a good idea and get funded on a very short time scale. So unlike a grant where it may be many months before you get the money and then several years to do the research, here we are expected to develop flight hardware from blank piece of paper all the way through mission readiness in a period of less than a year. So this is essentially 9 months. And so this funding is going to pay for labor. We have a collaboration with Georgia Tech, so some of the money goes there. But a lot of it is really going into the actual development of hardware that's going to fly, hopefully, in space next year.
I was so surprised by the short timeline. Like, how do you get your hardware ready for flight all through those certifications by April?
That is a question that we wrestle with every day. In fact, we'll have our team meeting today with our Georgia Tech colleagues, and we just do status updates, and we keep, you know, like any project, we keep updating the schedule, and usually things get pushed a little bit to the right as we figure out we don't know how to do things we thought we knew how to do, but we'll get there. We've done this before, never on such a tight timeline, but we've had plenty of projects that have gotten to the flight line, gotten to launch, just because we've got really creative students who are pushing the envelope here.
Not to mention, Kevin, that NASA is closed due to the government shutdown. How much of an obstacle is that for your research team and being able to push ahead with what you're creating here?
That's a bit of a wrinkle, for sure. One aspect of this program that is really helpful here is that it is a prize. And so we've been awarded a portion of the funds already, so we're not necessarily sidelined by the government shutdown. We do have site visits that are part of our due diligence here. And so a team from NASA was supposed to come earlier, I guess, well, actually this week was our scheduled site visit. And that has been postponed until the shutdown ends. But we'll have a group of folks coming to check out our hardware and make sure we're we're making progress toward goal here pretty soon.
Samadji, how do you get ready for a site visit and how are students a part of that?
It's interesting for me. This is my first time kind of dealing with something like this. But for me, I'm mainly just trying to make sure that, number one, our labs look good, because things can get kind of chaotic as we're working on not just the Tech League project, for some of the other Carthage projects. And so that's kind of our main goal, is to make sure everything looks good and make sure that we have the stuff that NASA wants to see ready for them when they show up.
Samadji, how might working on these real problems in space travel, how might that inform your career journey and what you hope to do next in life?
For me, I'd say a lot of it is just learning how to learn, for lack of better words. All of this is new. No one's really done what we're doing before. And so a lot of it is reading up on other studies and on other research projects that other professionals have done, and trying to find ways to creatively apply that to what we're doing here. And that kind of work, I think, is going to be very beneficial moving on, just to be able to come up with these creative solutions to new problems.
Kevin, when I think of refueling, a lot is on the line. Fuel is something that is so important to get us into space travel and to complete a mission. But you're also dealing with the fuel itself. Can you talk about the tensions there of the chemicals you have to deal with?
Sure. Yeah. As Samaje said, the idea is, you know, we don't want to throw away the rocket every time you run out of fuel, just as we don't toss the airline, you know, the jet after it lands in San Francisco. You don't throw it away when you're done with it. So this is a really serious obstacle toward building sustained human presence in space. On our end of it, we are not at the point where we're dealing with the very toxic propellant commodities that are actually planned for these missions. We're doing everything with simulants, so there's no danger to ourselves in the lab or anybody on the test campaigns. When we fly these in space, we use simulants that mimic the properties of the propellants but don't go boom in the night and can be handled safely by all of us.
But you could also be able to have simulations for what you're creating. Is that right? These parabolic flights?
Yeah, that's a really interesting aspect of our work. For about 20 years now, our laboratory has been the parabolic flight, the aircraft that delivers the parabolic flights. And this is a modified, currently it's a modified 727. And it essentially does these roller coaster maneuvers in the sky, and we're not in space. So in that sense, it's simulated, but we are experiencing true microgravity just in 22 second bursts. So the pilots maneuver the plane to create these rolling dives that essentially give us a free fall trajectory. And we do it over and over and over again, about 30 times for every flight. And that's our laboratory. That's how we test these technologies. At least that's how we have tested them for the last 20 years. Recently, in the last 10 years, the commercial suborbital market has come alive. So there are companies that provide actual access to space for our payloads, and that's slightly longer time scales. And so we've been flying on Blue Origin's New Shepard, and we have missions on Virgin Galactic, another provider of this of suborbital space access. So that's one of the great things about working in this field, is that your laboratory is kind of an interesting place, and it's up in the sky somewhere.
We're talking about a $500,000 NASA prize for research at Carthage College with Kevin Crosby, Carthage astronomy professor, and Samaje Farmer is here, a Carthage senior majoring in physics. Samaje, you have completed a summer internship at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston. Can you tell us a highlight or what you took away from it?
For me, the highlight was very much the environment there. I've had the opportunity to intern at many different places, just some, you know, regular run-of-the-mill corporate offices. And being at NASA, you see so much more passion in the work that they're doing there. And being there kind of gave me a nice guide for where I want to go in my future and the kind of environment that I want to work in. So that's the real highlight for me.
Kevin, you know, we've seen the White House's proposed budget cuts for NASA that could erase billions of dollars in funding for its science programs, for staff. Where do you see the agency's future going?
Yeah, I don't think that those cuts will materialize. I mean, I really certainly hope they don't. NASA, every dollar of investment into NASA returns 7 to 10-fold just in the economic value of the innovation that comes from trying to do hard things. So even though we're talking about problems in space, a lot of what even the small projects that we've been involved in have had translations to solving problems here on Earth. And that's, you know, really typical of NASA. There's an entire portion of the agency dedicated to these things, these technology spin-offs. And most people are unaware when they put on a pair of sunglasses or they use the camera on their phone or they feed infant formula to their baby that they are really benefiting from these technologies that were developed by NASA or through NASA during the early days of the Apollo missions all the way through shuttle. So these kinds of cuts would be devastating, not just to NASA, but to the world and to the country.
The research we're talking about is prize money, but what have you seen happen to grants? What do you have your eye on there?
Yeah, grants have been obviously heavily impacted by executive orders over the past year. We've had a lot of our grants stopped and rescinded in some cases. We've had to retool and resubmit to essentially abide by the language requirements of these executive orders that have come from the administration. So I would say that the flow of funding and therefore the pace of research and the pace of education, because NASA is also an advocate and a supporter and a center of STEM education for this country. All of that has been affected negatively by the attack on these agencies and the executive orders around grants.
Why does NASA need to reach out to small colleges like yours to get the innovation, the development, this hardware, for its spacecraft needs?
Well, I think the great thing about these prize competitions and about working with NASA itself is that they're not reaching out to small colleges necessarily. They're just accepting that there might be some good ideas at places other than the traditional gatekeepers. And so they have been very, very accepting of our proposals. And we've been invited to participate in several programs, technology development programs, education programs, that normally you'd think of as being the purview of some of the larger institutions. But NASA just likes good ideas, and they're willing to take them wherever they can find them.
Samajay, I've heard Carthage College called the home of NASA in Wisconsin. What impact has this research had, when you were thinking about colleges and where you wanted to go?
It had a fairly large impact. It was definitely unsure. Because that phrase is used, but the people who use it oftentimes aren't very involved in what we actually do in the research lab. So when the representative at my college fair was saying it, it sounded so cool to me, but I didn't know exactly what that entailed. And so for me, the main draw was just the fact that it was NASA. And so regardless of what the work was, if I get my foot in the door, and I get that NASA stamp on my resume, and I'm able to say that I have these experiences, then I just knew it would be invaluable one way or another.
And Kevin, you direct the Wisconsin Space Grant Consortium at Carthage. What makes Carthage stand out for space research in our state, and how is that consortium doing?
The consortium is doing well. Obviously, we are watching the shutdown unfold, and that is of great concern. The administration has proposed canceling all of NASA's education efforts. We don't think that will happen. We have traditionally had really bipartisan and bicameral support for not just education, but specifically for the space grant program, which has returned a large amount of revenue and kept students in the state, place them in industry within the state. So it's a very powerful program at the state level. There's one in every state. We provide essentially cradle to grave funding for K-12 outreach, undergraduate scholarships and graduate fellowships, internships with NASA, and faculty funding. So it's really sort of a one-stop shop for STEM educators and researchers to get seed funding to start projects like this.
As you work on this microgravity refueling hardware and the innovation behind it, you mentioned some private space companies earlier. I'm wondering how this technology is it that you're developing, is it proprietary to NASA? Would you end up working with SpaceX and Blue Origin, Boeing? How does that work?
Yeah, nothing is essentially proprietary to NASA. NASA's mission, of course, is in part to build the space economy. So in many cases, they are looking to transfer these technologies to companies. So they're not asserting any rights over the technologies or preventing us from working with other customers. In fact, with previous projects, some of our technologies have sort of graduated to commercial space and are being tested or employed in various capacities by commercial partners.
That's really must be really exciting to see how, you know, your innovations can be used not just in space, but in other realms as well.
Yeah, it's been great. I mean, I love working with these emerging companies who are much more focused. They can operate on much shorter timelines than the federal government can. But they, of course, then benefit from this paving the way, this building of the economy that NASA really does. Case in point is what we call LEO, or low Earth orbit, which has been dominated in the past by, you know, NASA vehicles and NASA missions and NASA satellites. But over the last 15 years, NASA has ceded that space intentionally to commercial interests. And now there's, you know, multi-billion-dollar economy in and infrastructure that's commercially owned and not NASA owned.
Well, Kevin and Samaje, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us. It's been great.
Of course. Thank you.
Kevin Crosby is a professor of physics, astronomy, and computer science at Carthage College and director of the Wisconsin Space Grant Consortium. Samaje Farmer is a senior majoring in physics at Carthage. He completed a summer internship at NASA's Johnson Space Center working on research to make in-space refueling more efficient. And we've been learning about a $500,000 prize from NASA to Carthage College for new space tech research.
Coming up, meet a Wisconsin fisher who set an ambitious goal to catch and video 1,000 different species in Wisconsin and beyond.
I'm in the teens right now. I just started this quest in late May, so I'm guessing it should last me the rest of my lifetime.
The 1,000 Fish Challenge, coming up next on WPR News. This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a remembrance of a Western Wisconsin singer.
In the early 1960s, New York City's Queen of the Beatniks was a young woman from Chippewa Falls. Judy Henske wowed audiences for decades with her deep, soulful voice, sadly passing away in 2022 at age 85. Writer Patty C. looks back on Henske's talent and Western Wisconsin's influence on the singer.
One of Woody Allen's most famous film characters was an aspiring singer from Chippewa Falls, loosely based on his one-time girlfriend, Judy Henske. I watched Annie Hall at McDonnell High, Judy's alma mater. Our English teacher recorded this 1977 Best Picture winner from TV to show us in 1984. At 16, I was thrilled our town was even mentioned in a movie, no matter how it was depicted, a podunk place from which creatives had no choice but to escape. This is not the story of how a Chippewa girl became Annie Hall. Much more interesting is how Judy Henske became Queen of the Beatniks, a title given to her by a record producer who also worked with the Rolling Stones.
And there's a high-flying bird way up in the sky.
In the early 1960s, Judy sang in Greenwich Village coffee houses where a stew of artists and poets hung out. This beat generation rejected consumerism and embraced free thought, like the bold and bawdy 6-foot-tall rising star they came to see. She talked about this in 2021, as a guest on Al Ross's Spectrum West show on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I think I was a natural beatnik. If you were a beatnik, practically all you ever did was read.
Judy signed with Elektra Records in 1963 when she was 26 years old. That same year, she was lauded in Time and Newsweek. One reviewer wrote, "Standing head and shoulders above the new contenders is a 6-foot hollyhock who is blooming with talent, praiseworthy for her singing of blues, folk ballads, and popular songs, as well as for her freely improvised patter."
I said, "Wait in the water."
Anyone who heard her even once recognized she belonged on stage. Before she became queen, she sang in the choir at Notre Dame Church. A nun once put a hymnal on Judy's chest and stood on it to help her develop vocal power. When you hear her wailing rendition of this spiritual, first sung by enslaved people, you can feel that power.
God's gonna trouble the water. Oh, they must have been a baby's Moses led. God's gonna trouble the water.
She once told a reporter, "I was a belting person. I had a harder edge to what I was doing." Judy appeared in clubs where she opened for Lenny Bruce and Woody Allen.
I sang at the Village Gate, which was not a folk music club. It was much more a jazz club.
Judy never forgot her roots. In 1964, she turned down a recurring role on the Judy Garland Show after being asked to do a skit that made fun of Midwestern farmers. She remembered, "I told them this isn't funny. It doesn't have anything to do with being from a small town." In 2021, when Judy appeared on Spectrum West, no one knew it would be her final interview for a Wisconsin audience. Judy died 6 months later. Her obituary in the New York Times claimed her voice conjured Billie Holiday and foreshadowed Janis Joplin. Judy told Al,
"I don't want to talk about music. I want to talk about Chippewa."
And she pronounced it like the rest of us natives.
"I know you right up gonna miss me when I'm gone."
Writer Patty C. brought us that tribute to Judy Henske, a Chippewa Falls native and the crowned queen of the beatniks. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lolan Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today.
The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources estimates that the state has over 160 species of fish in its waters.
That isn't enough for Slinger Middle School language arts teacher David Tiefenthaler.
When he's not teaching seventh graders the finer points of grammar and spelling, you can find him casting a line in a local lake or river and seeing what bites.
Tiefenthaler is now on a quest to catch 1,000 different fish species in Wisconsin and beyond and record an educational video about each one.
The wider fishing community has taken notice, and now more than 30,000 people subscribe to his YouTube channel, and tens of millions of people have viewed his TikToks under the name T-Fish. Here's a listen.
The quest to catch 1,000 different fish species on video continues with my arch nemesis, the northern hogsucker. This sneaky sucker has eluded me in the past, but thanks to Josh, not today.
I talked to David Tiefenthaler about sharing his love for fishing and the progress he's making on that goal. All right, 1,000 fish species. That's a pretty big goal. What made you set the bar so high?
Well, I should start from when I got into fishing as an adult. There's a river near me, the Rock River, and I went fishing in Hustisford where it crosses like Highway 60. And I saw a fish I'd never seen before in my life, a buffalo. And I was like, this is a fish? This is something that's in Wisconsin? Because I was used to fishing for the typical things you'd find in a Wisconsin lake. And it just kind of got my mind racing. And I started looking it up and I found a poster that I believe the Wisconsin DNR put out where it has all the fishes of Wisconsin. And I'm saying that right. plural for fish species is fishes.
I'm that's going with the, it. Yeah, it works for me.
Yeah, that's the English teacher in me. So I am saying that right. And there's over 170 different fish species in Wisconsin. So years and years ago, I made it a goal to catch 50 different fish species in Wisconsin. And I did that, and I made videos about it because that's another hobby of mine. I like making videos. And after I accomplished that, I still made fishing videos, but I didn't really have like a clear direction for a long time. And so I came back to the goal of catching different fish species. And I was like, well, what's a big round number? So I went with 1,000. So that's just kind of how it got started. And I mean, I'm in the teens right now. I just started this quest in late May. So I'm guessing it should last me the rest of my lifetime.
And I'm not a math expert, but you said 170 or so species in Wisconsin. You're aiming for 1,000. The vision must be, therefore, you're going to do this outside of Wisconsin too?
Yeah, I was looking at, you know, my future, and I'm losing my children. They're all growing up and moving away. I've got two in college now, and my youngest is a junior in high school. So I know, you know, in the future, I'll be able to go places and try and catch fish, and it'll give me an excuse to vacation in different areas because there might be unique fish species there. So yes, I will have to venture out of Wisconsin to continue the quest. So far, I have not.
What is it about fishing that you love? Because some people love fishing and some people look at it and think, well, that looks kind of boring. What is it for you?
I have a mind that races and wanders, and it just clears everything. You're in the moment. You know, there's nothing else that's going through my mind other than just being on the water. It's, and I've always had a connection to the water. I just love being on it. It's just, and it doesn't matter if I'm in the middle of the city, like in Milwaukee, fishing on the Milwaukee River, or if I'm, you know, way out in Canada, just being on the water, there's something about it that just calms my mind. And then also the pursuit of a fish, you know, it keeps me, all the extraneous things, all my worries, they fade away. It's something that I truly enjoy because of that.
Now, getting back to the 1,000 quest here, you'd hit that 50 in the past. Do those 50 count, or are you starting from zero again?
I'm starting from zero because when I looked at the old videos that I did in the past, a lot of times I just stumble across a fish and I wouldn't even know what it was. And so it was fun to catch those fish and then get help identifying them. But then when I look back, I was like, I should have a standard format for these videos. And so what I do now is the first minute or two of the video is just going over what this fish species is, how to catch it, what habitat it likes, what's the world record, if there is one for that fish. And then after that, it's me just out there trying to catch it. So I felt like my previous videos weren't really educational. It was just like, hey, Dave's fishing, come along. But now, and maybe that's the educator in me, I felt like if someone were to stumble across my video, it gives them a lot more help if they want to try to catch that fish as well. Also, there's so much history behind different fish species in Wisconsin, at least, that is fascinating.
All right. So your being a teacher influences how you do your fishing videos. Do your fishing quests influence your teaching? Are you able to bring those experiences into the classroom with you?
Yes and no. I know I could bore the tears, bore some kids to tears. You know, I've been teaching for a long time. And one of the things that they say that really helps is to like develop a relationship with the students. And I've never had a problem with that. But having a hobby is such a very easy way to connect with kids, to show them that you're interested in something outside of the school walls, because then they're way more likely to share their interests with you. And then they learn in turn that, you know, I'm a beginner at something. You know, every time I'm trying to catch a new fish species, I'm a beginner, just like they are whenever they're trying to write compound complex sentences. Who knows? You know, so it's a good way to show that, you know, we're all learning no matter what age.
We're talking about fishing and a quest to catch and document 1,000 fish species with Dave Tiefenthaler, a Slinger Middle School language arts teacher and obviously avid fisherman. Dave, what got you into wanting to do videos of your fishing and not just do them and share them, but it sounds like improve them over time?
Well, that's actually what I went to college for. I was at UW-Oshkosh, a radio TV film major. And when I graduated, I worked in radio for a year, realized I didn't really like that path. And then I went back and got my teaching degree, but I still had that itch to create. I love creating things. So when I started to get into fishing, I thought this would be cool to document this on video. And so it's like a combination of things. It's one of my interests, something I had a background in, like I've learned how to video edit before. And so I enjoy the editing of the video just as much as the fishing. One thing that's happened too, because of me chasing different fish species, I've met a lot of people that like to catch these unique fish species. So it's almost come, it's become kind of a community activity too. It's kind of crazy in a way.
I was going to ask, how much are you catching and releasing versus cooking them up?
I would say half and half. The fish species that are stocked, like salmon in the Great Lakes, if I can catch them before they make their spawning run, I'll keep those because I find salmon delicious. But I'm not great at filleting fish yet, so I kind of have a, if it's 12 inches or smaller, I typically let it go. If it's bigger than that, and I know there's enough of them in the area, like I practice selective harvest, I'll keep them. But for instance, it's interesting when you hear of different people catching and keeping fish or catching and releasing them. I really like eating catfish, but a lot of people are like, oh, that's a bottom feeder. That doesn't taste good. Well, in my experience, they're good. Another one that is a game fish that most people release, largemouth bass. I like eating largemouth bass. So if I catch ones that are legal limit, I'll keep a couple of those too. So it all depends, but I'd say about half of the times I go fishing, I'll keep a fish to eat.
And then when you start questing beyond Wisconsin, you're doing some research, I assume. What is a fish you really want to catch out there in the world?
I know this is the typical thing, but tarpon. I would love to catch a tarpon in Florida. I've had a situation before where I was on a vacation in Florida. I caught a small fish and I threw it out as bait, and a tarpon broke my rod in half. So I did not land that fish. So that's one that I feel like I have some unfinished business.
There's a little revenge needed there.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's one I have had an encounter with, but have not landed. I would like to land. That would be a one that I definitely have circled.
Dave, good luck on the quest and thanks so much for joining us.
No, thanks for having me.
Dave Tiefenthaler is an English language arts teacher at Slinger Middle School. He joined us to share his love for fishing and his mission to catch and record educational videos of 1,000 different fish species. You can follow his progress on his TikTok or YouTube channel, T-Fish. Find a link to those over at WPR.org. Coming up on Monday, we'll look at men in the nursing profession with a professor at UW-Oshkosh, where the nursing program has gotten national recognition for bringing men into the field, which is about 90% women.
And we want to hear stories of men working in nursing. Are we talking about you? Share your experiences with us, and we can share them on the air.
Email wisconsintoday at WPR.org to tell us about your story.
Or you can call or text us at our comment line. The number there is 888-642-0232.
Again, we want to hear from men who have worked as nurses. Email wisconsintoday at WPR.org or call or text 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence and Royce Padeswa.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Tim Peterson is our managing producer. Dean Knetter is our executive producer.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for listening to WPR News.